Here comes the 296th opening of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. This show is dedicated to Danny Williams, Premier of Newfoundland and Labrador. He stood up to Abitibi Bowater by nationalizing land and water rights when the company closed a mill using them. Abitibi had been granted conditional access to the people's resources as long as they were used to create jobs and contribute to development of the province. Abitibi chose to close their mill and planned to sell their rights to others. Danny put the brakes on this sale, noting that the corporation did not own these assets, but only held them in usufruct. When they fail to use the resources as agreed, they revert to the province, period. Gordon Campbell, are you paying attention? Will you follow Danny's example by reclaiming for British Columbia the land and water rights granted to Alcan on condition of their producing aluminum and jobs in the Northwest? Fat chance. Gordon's a steadfast friend of corporations, willingly turning our resources over to all comers. It's very sad. Abitibi threatens to take their case for retaining water and timber rights to a NAFTA tribunal. Danny Williams is sanguine over the prospect. Newfoundland didn't sign that traitorous agreement, so if a NAFTA body finds that his nationalization to be contrary to its terms, it will be the federal government, not the provincial, liable for reparations. A most interesting constitutional question arises here. Is it within the power of our federal government to enter into international treaties binding provinces to terms affecting areas of their undisputed jurisdiction? If the Supreme Court finds that the feds overstepped their bounds with NAFTA, it could invalidate a whole class of free trade agreements to which Canada has become signatory. It might not be an unalloyed disaster if we were forced to renounce the NAFTA. This might be a good time to sever some of the more onerous ties that have bound us to the sinking ship, which is the American economy. My family survived another Christmas in good shape, if a bit heavier all around. My wish is that you can say the same and that you likewise make it through the festivities of New Year's, landing on your feet, prepared for the rigors of another long stretch of routine, unbroken by nasty holidays. Since Nelson area listeners will still catch my shows next year, you'll be able to experience the latest technical innovation from the spacious studios of CFUR. Closed captioning for the hearing impaired. Watch for this in 2009. Onward and upward with community radio for the masses. Now here's one that my wife didn't believe. I hope that some of you out there were more fortunate than I in what you found under the Christmas tree, or the Hanukkah bush, or whatever you call it. Some lucky devils found a new men's body spray, whatever that is, called Flame. Flame is a product of Burger King, fair dinkum, the folks who flog grease burgers across our wide continent. Flame is touted by the company as having, quote, the scent of seduction with a hint of flame-broiled meat. It must be true. I read it in the Globe and Mail. The Canadian Senate was intended to be a place of sober second thought, where legislation passed by the elected House would be reviewed and filtered of impetuous acts. The founders of our government never completely trusted the Democratic House, and for good reason. It's as though they foresaw the ascendancy of such a bunch as we now have in power. There were then hopes that future prime ministers would appoint the best of men and women to seats in the Senate, where they would apply their collective wisdom to act as a brake on the House. Fast forward to the 21st century, we find Senate seats filled by, or often empty of, people parked there for many reasons. Some were, indeed, good folk chosen for their abilities and accomplishments. Others have been political rivals selected to get them out of circulation. Some were appointed for past slavish service to their party. Our prime hypocrite, Stephen Harper, now without the confidence of the House and supposedly running a caretaker administration after his precipitous dumping of Parliament, has made 18 appointments to our Senate. Our Senate. Has he chosen eminent persons outstanding for their public service on behalf of their fellow citizens? If so, they've been well hidden amongst a crew of rejected candidates, bagman, hacks, and jocks. All they share is a subservience to the mighty Harper and his misguided policies. They believe in an elected Senate, which is why they were arbitrarily selected by that mighty, omniscient Harper. Prime hypocrite Harper has played one consistent tune ever since he rose from the slime of the so-called National Citizens Coalition, a misnamed coterie of rich right-wingers. He and his backers have trumpeted the Tripoli Senate. Senators should be democratically elected. In support of this principle, he has grossly violated it. Why would he do this? To cause lasting damage to Canadian politics before his possible unseating from his perch by a majority of House members. This coalition was on the verge of ousting Harper when he, with the connivance of the Governor General, pulled the plug and prorogued Parliament. It was a devious, cowardly act, which has now been compounded by his stuffing the Senate and the Supreme Court with obedient individuals who owe him and his party above country. If Harper got his wish for an elected Senate, what would this accomplish? It would open this body to the same pressures as its sister in Parliament. Candidates would have to launch expensive campaigns leading to expensive elections. They would pander to the same wealthy persons and corporations for funding, repaying their donors in beneficial legislation. Such a reform would have no benefit and many costs to Canadians. If any change were in order, and I don't see one as urgent, it would be the complete abolition of the Senate. Yes, there are Senate committees doing important work, but none that cannot be handled by ad hoc groups of intelligent, disinterested persons. It's been calculated that senators, aside from their salaries of over $130,000 and travel expenses of $90,000, incur other costs to the public, bringing their annual per capita drain on the public purse to nearly $1 million. As a stimulus to the economy, Harper's appointments will be adding about $15 million in spending each year for the next eight. Of course, those 18 individuals of such grand accomplishments, did somebody say skiing, will resign, as promised, in just 8 years. File that promise in the compartment reserve for other conservative promises, and thank goodness that Sarah Palin is not a Canadian, or she might also now have a Senate seat. The fall in crude oil prices has not been well reflected in retail prices we pay at the pumps, but they have fallen far enough to bring relief to our fellow broadcasters here in Prince George. The CBC studio on Victoria Street lies next to a Tim Hortons and beneath a large sign reading CBC 91.5. With gas prices in the 78 to 80 cent range, drivers are no longer walking in under that 91.5 sign asking where the pumps are. A few long decades ago, I was associated with a woman who had a beautiful voice in spite of her disgusting smoking habit. One of her favorites began, "Oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz?" We eventually parted, not on the best of terms. Earlier this year, I would have gladly fulfilled her wish. 4 years ago, my wife and I bought a beautiful old Mercedes-Benz on impulse, learning the hard lesson that you should never test drive a vehicle you can't afford. It was a pleasure to drive when it ran. Our last trip to Vancouver Island, it broke down not once, but twice, costing us the better part of $2,000 in repairs. This proved to be less a trusty vehicle than an ongoing investment opportunity. After attempting to sell it at a deep discount, we gave the bloody machine to CNC's auto mechanic program for them to play with. I could have looked up that old friend and given her the Mercedes she coveted, but we didn't part on terms that bad. It may be a relief to you to learn that not all of us, even executives of hard-pressed firms receiving public aid, are suffering. Investigators have found that six financial outfits receiving some of those billions of dollars thrown around still own and operate corporate jets, which continue to be used by bigwigs flitting around to company events and even personal holidays. Isn't it comforting to know that such important, productive people don't waste precious time lined up with the hoi polloi in airports? Each month, Harper's Magazine publishes a page of statistics they call Harper's Index. The January edition has the best of this year's figures, of which I will read some. 39% of Americans believe that U.S. Muslims should have to carry special identification. I guess no one was asked whether U.S. Christians should bear such documentation, nor were they queried as to whether a visible yellow Star of David should be worn by Jews. Here's another one. George Bush issued at least 1,069 signing statements exempting his administration from enforcing laws passed by Congress. Thus, he set his coterie of officials above the laws of the land and the U.S. Constitution. Since 2000, American emigration to Canada has increased by 79%. The more the merrier, if they are dissenters and, one would wish, deserters from the American armed forces. During the Bush regime, 3/4 of U.S. income gains have gone to the wealthiest 1% of earners. During that time, the number of people living on less than half the official poverty level has increased by 3.5 million. This speaks for itself and makes Canada's conservatives envious. 92 American U.S. cities and towns have passed resolutions calling for the impeachment of George Wanker Bush. So what's the matter with the rest? Since 2001, the U.S. government increased its spending on paper shredding by 466%. We have no comparable figures on costs for Stephen Harper's open and accountable government. The fastest-growing name given to American newborns since 2000 is Neva. That's heaven spelled backwards. Good grief. It's estimated that Bush-era policies have cost the U.S. government $10 and one-third trillion in new debt and accrued obligations. No mention as to how this indebtedness, amounting to $30,000 for every American, can ever be redeemed. Save your Yankee dollars, boys, although they may be worth less than toilet paper one day. 37% of Americans approved of George Bush's regime's job during his second term. 37% of Russians now approve of the operation of their country under Joseph Stalin. No comment. I'll be leaving my copy of Harper's Magazine at the PIRG office at UNBC if you're interested in reading more 21st century statistics. I've been searching my library trying to find out whether our dear Mr. Harper has the authority to appoint senators and fill other patronage jobs when Parliament is prorogued. It's beyond me for sure, and it also seems to be for constitutional experts. Does the Governor General have to give approval for such appointments while Parliament is prorogued? When the Prime Minister faces a non-confidence motion, is his regime restricted to basic housekeeping functions until Parliament resumes? And what did the GG and PM discuss for 2 hours when he petitioned her to save his bacon? Did she set any conditions? Here's my New Year's wish, that Harper's stuffing of Supreme Court and Senate with stooges violated his agreement with the Governor General and that she has the power to rescind them all. Wouldn't that be sweet? Looking at the list of 18 folks Harper chose to fill Senate seats, it was obvious that he had not picked the best candidates available. He could have chosen from any number of Canadians who have served their country well, but instead he found faithful party hacks, bagmen, and stooges, not to mention one whose outstanding contribution to her country was the rapid descent of snowy hillsides on a matched pair of slats. Then it became clear. Harper deliberately selected mediocre people who would not distinguish themselves in Canada's Senate. He wants a Senate of low achievement, making it easier to point to it as a place of inferior talent and no outstanding output, all the easier to collect support for the body's abolition or for replacement of appointments with elected members. I don't know whether Harper is the smartest man in the room as he fancies himself, but I give him full marks for being the most devious and cunning. Too bad he won't apply his talents to improving the lot of Canadians. When Jim Flaherty presented that so-called economic plan triggering formation of the opposition coalition, why wasn't he given the boot? That's a no-brainer. He was no more responsible for that travesty than as a hand puppet liable for words of his ventriloquist. Seldom is there such a vicious control freak in a democracy as our own Stephen Harper. We expect it in dictatorships like Mugabe's Zimbabwe or Stalin's Soviet Union, but not in a parliamentary system. Harper has appointed a gaggle of 38 ministers, but relinquished no responsibilities to them. Under Harper, a ministerial position is merely a reward of staff, salary, and perquisites for faithful mouthpieces. Under a functioning parliamentary system, the Prime Minister allocates power as well as nominal positions to his caucus. A real finance minister would have resigned after being made a fool, first by declaring that there would be no budget deficit on his watch, then presenting the House with a vicious attack on the opposition under the guise of a fiscal update, and now making a silly, ill-founded prediction that the deficit, the one that would never happen on his watch, will be short-lived. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Harper's Conservative Party and its predecessors fought to establish a parliamentary review process for the selection of nominees for our Supreme Court. That system is now in place. While operating without the confidence of the House, Harper bypassed his own system to parachute Thomas Cromwell into a vacant Supreme Court position. Our dear Prime Minister felt no urgency in filling this spot, which has been without an incumbent for some time, but Harper found his job in jeopardy and declared a newfound emergency. He emphasized that his sudden move was in response to a singularly urgent need, and that henceforth appointments would undergo parliamentary scrutiny. He didn't state so explicitly, but we know that this will be binding only on a future opposition government, not on a conservative one. After all, this was just a promise, and conservative promises are not binding. Justice Cromwell is a distinguished jurist, but he is known to believe that our Charter of Rights is to be applied sparingly in striking down legislation passed by Parliament. Definition: don't rely on a Supreme Court supporting civil rights when they are abridged by laws. Expect the police to be under the mildest of restraints when pitted against rights of the accused. If you were trying to boost our economy, where would you put taxpayer dollars so they would circulate? Would you throw money at fat banks and huge corporations? They're doing this right now, and we find that banks are not circulating their gift money. They're paying dividends, buying back their stock, making foreign acquisitions, and rewarding their executives. Putting billions into dinosaur industries is pouring it down a rat hole. Those corporations cannot reform themselves under present management. They'll blow our billions and come back for more and more and more, always screaming that they are preserving jobs. That's bullshit, as the efficiencies they claim to want will involve massive layoffs and drastic cuts to wages and benefits. They've mishandled employee pension funds entrusted to their care while granting the hierarchy billions in unearned pay. If you want to inject money to circulate, you don't lavish it on the rich, but on the poor. Money distributed to the homeless, the unemployed, and those on the edge of survival is not stashed under the mattress or invested in bonds. It is spent, and it works its way through the economy. Such a stimulus would not suit Harper's conservatives. It would negate his efforts to create a two-tier economy of have-nots on one end and the super-rich on the other, with a slender middle class between. So money will be injected into things of no benefit to the average person. One of these is a proposed massive spending spree on military equipment, all financed by a budget deficit causing bonds to be issued to his wealthy backers. Dumping money into military equipment is not just wasted, but it helps fuel our end of a worldwide arms race. All this at a time when we have no credible enemies abroad except those we create ourselves, largely with our own military actions. Harper wants to buy hundreds of army trucks and special military vehicles as a disguised subsidy to the American Big Three auto companies. He would buy a number of off-the-shelf cars and trucks, civilian vehicles painted in camouflage colors. GM could unload unsold cars and trucks from lots across the country with just a coat of paint and a fancy price tag. Look at the money that could be lavished on manufacturers just replacing the expensive stuff blown up and run into the ground in our war against Afghanistan. Businessmen are drooling over the goodies to be dispensed. Maybe we could even throw a billion or two into the ongoing attempts to make our British junk submarines only sink when we want them to. This holiday time has special personal meanings for everyone in our culture. It rouses a whole gamut of feelings, from the warmth of tender childhood holidays to the stress of trying to resurrect those feelings in one's own children. There's a subliminal quest for celebration in anticipation of long weeks of work or study unbroken by holidays through the coming winter. My wife and I are among that fortunate class of retirees financially secure enough to sail through today's turmoil as observers, not participants. We have the luxury of unburdened reminiscence. This season means many things to me. I recall pleasant holidays from school spent with my family. Then I left to seek my fortune, finding myself wasting three consecutive Christmases on a military base in occupied Panama, cursing the heat. A few years later, Christmas found me back with my family on holiday from grad school, secretly plotting a drastic move. I had had it with the academic pursuits, promising to lead me to a career of lucrative drudgery. To hell with it, and to hell with a society that was deeply engaged in a brutal war against Vietnam. That Boxing Day, I rode the bus to my school in upstate New York, where I picked up a suitcase and the papers I had quietly prepared. Another bus took me to Fort Erie, Ontario, where I presented these papers, and 15 minutes later, I was a genuine Canadian landed immigrant. That was on the 28th of December, 1967, so I had just caught the tail end of Canada's centenary year. A night in Toronto, and I bussed back to the family, where I announced that I was dropping my studies and going to find a job. My parents were shocked. They asked where I intended to seek work, and I replied, Toronto. My mother, quick-witted as always, replied, but that's in Canada. She was a crossword aficionado, and there was no fooling her. I was joining the flood of American immigrants entering Canada as I had had a bellyful of the Vietnam War, and I saw Canada as a peaceful land of opportunity. My father, being one of those knee-jerk veteran my country righter wrong right-wingers, predictably exploded. We had a long, loud argument about the Vietnam invasion. He dragged out the standard rationalizations about the domino theory, the terrible communists oppressing the peasants, and all the rest. I fired back all the refutals, and we reached a standoff. I left the family hearth with harsh words ringing in my ears. I found that work was scarce in Toronto. I registered with Manpower and a couple of private employment agencies, submitting many resumes, and attended more interviews than I can recall. My plan called for me to don a suit and seek an executive trainee position one day, and dress in casual gear applying for laboring jobs the next. On a lark, I attended a job fair held by INCO at the local Manpower office. I was about to apply when one fellow, rejected by the company, advised me that they were not hiring anyone with more than a high school education. I shortened my application at that level and was hired on the spot. A few days later, I found myself on a train to Sudbury. On arrival, I checked my bags at the bus station and went straight to the company office where I completed more paperwork. When pressed for a local address, I gave that of the bus station. My months with INCO taught me many lessons I would not have learned in any classroom. Underground mining work is hard and dangerous. Those who are claustrophobic or aren't comfortable with arduous labor and constant threat of a hostile environment don't last long. I held on for a few months, long enough to gain a great respect for those miners, the hardest working of which were the Newfoundlanders. My gods, those guys put in a hard day's work. I learned that the roof of that mine, although 300 meters thick, leaked. We were constantly wet. The air was a steady 13 degrees at our level, summer and winter. Granite makes a good insulator at that depth. I learned that the earth is alive and moving. When we arrived for our shift, the first thing we had to do was test the roof in the working area beyond where it was secured with roof bolts and expanded metal screening. With a long pole, we'd tap overhead looking for spots with a hollow ring. When we found one, we'd poke and pry until dislodging rock that loosened with shifting. At the end of a drift, away from the sound of machines and blasting, one could sit quietly and listen to a faint, high-pitched singing as the layers of granite grated against one another. Miners worked in pairs for safety. Long-timers had permanent partners who became closer than their spouses. Spending 8 hours every day with a man upon whose judgment one's life depends firms up a friendship. I found that miners haven't just an occupation, but a cult. Those working underground have an exclusivity that doesn't recognize any job exposed to sunlight as real work. Work is performed in man-made underground tunnels, and all the rest of human occupation is just stamp collecting. I was there long enough to understand this feeling, but not enough to be thoroughly indoctrinated. It made me realize the angst felt by miners displaced through automation or mine closings when faced with having to work above ground. You can't take a miner and put him behind the wheel of a truck or sit him at a desk for 8 hours. The analogy of a fish out of water is apt. One fine spring day, I was working with a new partner as my regular one had quit. We were working on a stope, a vertical cut that would join up with the working area on the next level above us. At that point, the rock grain was nearly vertical, and each time we began drilling, we'd be showered with bits of debris, small and large. I made the comment that for 2 cents I'd quit this job. My partner dug 2 pennies from his pocket, calling my bluff. I promptly found the shift boss and told him to call a cage. I went to the surface, turned in my lamp, showered, dumped my work clothes in the trash, picked up my final pay, and kissed Sudbury goodbye. No more mining for me, I thought. I still have those 2 pennies. It wasn't until 4 years later that I worked underground in Australia, but that's another story. I have no regrets as to the direction my life has taken as I caromed from place to place and job to job. It was a wild and wondrous journey, sometimes arduous, sometimes laid back. When I look at my 10-year-old grandson, I wonder what adventures and travails await him in our rapidly changing world. His ambition is not to have a job, but to become a celebrity living in Los Angeles. Boy, does he have a lot to learn. The Vietnam War did not come to an end through negotiation, nor victory for either side. It dragged to a close due to the collapse of American morale at home and on the battlefield. Nixon had been reelected on the promise of a secret plan to end the conflict rapidly. That was a bald lie. His intent was to grind onward until the Vietnamese people were completely crushed. The American effort finally fizzled when a huge anti-war movement emerged at home and a quiet rebellion developed amongst troops in the field. I was told about this revolt by a couple of former soldiers. One said that when his platoon was ordered to patrol, they went out of sight, smoked a joint or two, then returned to report no contact. Another said that his unit had engaged in a firefight only to have an officer order that they return and count enemy bodies. The same reaction: a walk into the jungle, a toke or two, and return with a fabricated figure. These body counts became so unreliable that the media ceased reporting them. As the military resistance evolved, there were cases of soldiers ordered to go on patrol who told their officers to go themselves if that was so damned important. Morale collapsed quite thoroughly toward the end of the war, so Nixon ordered a retreat under the cover of what was called Vietnamization, or turning the fighting over to puppet South Vietnamese troops. This army was riddled with enemy sympathizers, and it soon collapsed under its own weight, leaving the last Americans to escape from the roof of the Saigon embassy by helicopter. May we see a similar end to the wars against Iraq and Afghanistan? Already, Bush has announced that his soldiers would be removed to bases in Iraq, leaving fighting to a colonial army of dubious fealty and to various warlords financed by the U.S. The Americans got what they wanted, virtual privatization of the huge oil resources of that country. Why hang around the cities, which are irrelevant to these oil resources? Keep enough soldiers there to guard the remote wells and pipelines, and let the rest of the country go to hell in its own ways. Might this also be the fate of Canada's Afghan adventure? December was the worst month this year for Canadian deaths. We passed 100 now, and betting pools are taking wagers when the toll will hit 200. We may see the day when the Canadian public and or military refuses to take it anymore. Soldiers may rebel in the face of repeated tours of duty and the incredible stress of driving down roads which may explode beneath them at any time. Civilians at home may rebel at seeing our resources and soldiers squandered to support the ambitions of a lame duck foreign president at a time when our home economy sorely needs domestic spending. With any luck, a future leader of Canada, sooner or later, will see the light and get us out of Afghanistan while we still have some credibility in the world. This has been the 296th Porcupine Petting Zoo, the last for 2008. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM, and I remain Uncle Don. Happy New Year, everyone.